We now have a new challenge, perhaps the most monumental in recorded history. The opportunity to investigate a phenomenon that could change our destiny. A look at ourselves 1,000 years in the future.
We're going to examine and perhaps question some widely held theories of what may have happened to this Earth of ours. We're going to investigate some strange and bizarre events in the present. Unbelievable happenings as fresh as today's headlines. And more important, perhaps, we're going to take a searching and scientific look into the future. We're reaching more and more out into space. Perhaps, as we may learn, someone, something, somewhere in space is reaching out to us.
Who the visitors are, where they're from, and what they want is unknown.
Bigfoot was attracting national attention and was now rapidly becoming the most intriguing mystery on the North American continent.
Many people have seen ghosts and reported incredible experiences from the realm of the spirit world. Who can tell what this young man will see as he falls deep into a trance?
Welcome to After Dark Radio with your host, Ryan Alvarez.
Hey, everybody. Ryan Alvarez here. After Dark Radio, Dark Matter Radio Network, Friday night, July 25, 2014, here on the Dark Matter Radio Network. Did you even know I was gone last week? Last week was, in fact, a replay show from 11-11-11, November 11, 2011, our interview with Stanton Friedman. Great show. Great interview with Stanton. That was last week. I was away in Calgary, and so we did a replay show. But tonight, we are live, and we've got a great show here for you. We're going to be joined a little bit later on this evening by a very interesting fella. His name is Thierry Legault, and he's going to be joining us in a pre-taped interview that was done about a week ago from France. Thierry lives in France, and if you want more information on him, instead of attempting to spell Thierry Legault, you can go to www.astrophoto.fr. That is www.astrophoto.fr. Now, Thierry Legault is an amateur photographer, but do not let the amateur part fool you. He is an amazing photographer, and if you go up to his website, you can check it out. Some amazing celestial photography. He has put out a book called Astrophotography, which you can check out on his website as well. And to give you an idea of some of the stuff we're going to be talking about here tonight, he has got photos taken from the Earth of the International Space Station passing in front of the sun. He has got amazing photos of the surface of the moon. He's got some amazing photos from out beyond our solar system. And he is the first human being to take a photograph from the Earth of an astronaut doing a spacewalk. That's right. He took a photograph from the Earth of the space station, and there is an astronaut doing a spacewalk that you can see in the photograph. He's got photographs here taken from the Earth of the space shuttle. He's got all sorts of amazing photographs, and we are going to talk to him about all of his work. And listen, for those of you that that believe that we are being visited by individuals from perhaps another planet, perhaps trying to visit Earth from far, far away, few people would be better to ask this question to than Thierry Legault, because he is constantly monitoring. He does not work for any major space organization, so you don't have to worry about any sort of cover-up. He is a civilian who takes photographs of satellites, including, I might add, spy satellites. He takes photos of spy satellites. And so if anybody would know if anything strange has been entering our atmosphere, it is Thierry Legault. So he's going to be on the program in about 20 minutes, and it's going to be a good time. As always, we've got a lot of interesting things to talk about here today. I've got a lot of news stories, that I want to read to you here today. Of course, you can follow along at any time on our website, afterdarkradioshow.com. And I recommend you head over there because everything you ever want to know about this show is available on that website. For example, let's say you want to call in tonight because we are going to be doing open line phone calls here. The phone number is 855-478-4478, toll free in the U.S. and Canada. And if, for example, you forget the phone number, you can go to AfterDarkRadioShow.com, and there it is. Also on the website is my email address, Brian@WrestlingObserver.com. You can email me and put After Dark in the subject line. I'll read as many of those as I can this evening. And by the way, if you are listening to this program right now and you think that you, for whatever reason, would be a great guest on the After Dark Radio Show, there is guest booking information. You can contact producer Garrett, and hopefully he can set you up to be on this program if you would be an interesting guest. That is up there as well. Our Twitter feed. You can follow me at Brian Alvarez on Twitter. And if there's anything interesting on the program here tonight, I will be tweeting that out. So make sure you follow me at Brian Alvarez on Twitter. And our live Twitter feed is available up there on the After Dark Radio Show website as well. In addition, if you happen to miss the July 12th show, that was the show with Paul Hayes of the Genosqua Project. You can go up there and listen to the program. 2-hour show. We talked to Paul about all sorts of interesting Bigfoot-related topics. He had a personal first-hand sighting of a Bigfoot. And if you miss the show and you want to hear about that, you can head up to AfterDarkRadioShow.com, download that show. It is only going to be there for about 2 hours, because when this show ends, this show will replace that one on AfterDarkRadioShow.com. So if you have not had a chance to hear the Paul Hayes show, I recommend you go up there right now and grab it, because after this program ends, that show will no longer be available on the website for download. So grab it now while you can. And if you miss any part of this show, if you happen to fall asleep or you tune in late, you can always go up after the program and check it out on the AfterDarkRadioShow.com website. The phone numbers again, 855-478-4478. If you would like to give us a call, the phone lines are open from now until 11:30 p.m. Pacific, 2:30 a.m. Eastern, and we'll probably take some phone calls after the interview with Thierry Lego as well. So if you've got anything on your mind, you can give us a call right now, particularly if it's anything involving anything that we're talking about in the news here. I want to mention this first off, since I was in Calgary last week. We actually, we drove, it's kind of an interesting story, we drove from Seattle to Calgary, and about a month ago actually, we had David Politis on the show of Missing 411. And he, of course, talks about missing persons in national parks. And my buddy Lance, we were going up to visit him in Calgary. And we were trying to think of things to do for the weekend. And Lance said, have you guys ever been to Banff? And I had not been to Banff. My wife had, but I had not. And so the idea was we would drive from Seattle and meet them in Banff the next day and take a look around. Banff is an awesome place, by the way, if you've never gone. But if you check out some of David Politis's work, hey, people disappear up there in Banff. So that was interesting to be able to go up there. Nobody I knew disappeared. We certainly didn't hike out into remote areas or anything like that, but I did go up in a gondola? I think I called it a gondola, and they laughed at me. It's a gondola. But we did go to the top of the mountain in the gondola. That was a lot of fun. So a good time was had by all. But anyway, that's where I was last week. And so I was very interested when I saw this news story here from the Calgary Herald. What the heck was that? Fireball flashes across the Calgary sky. This was from July 23rd. We had gone home, we left on Monday morning, and so I just missed this fireball here. Some Albertans who were up early Tuesday were treated to a rare sight when a fireball lit up the night sky. The Rothany Observatory reports that a fireball, which is larger than a meteor, was seen at 1:24 a.m. on Tuesday. They're so bright that if you're standing, you will see your shadow, just like in the daytime. said Dr. Phil Langille, who directs the University of Calgary Observatory. A meteor is a small rock from outer space that burns up as it enters Earth's atmosphere. Langille said a fireball is even larger. Essentially the same thing, and it's just a matter of scale. Scores of people took to Twitter and emailed the Herald about the sudden flash of light. Jesse Shan was on his south-facing MARTA Loop balcony when he saw what appeared to be cloudless lightning just southeast of the city. I saw a massive flash to begin with. I was like, whoa, said Shan. He saw a blue-white streak followed by a burning orange orb that moved slowly, lingering for about 5 seconds before vanishing. It was almost like it entered out of nowhere and then exited again. It was just ridiculous, he said. Other Calgarians reported a green flash, comparing the sight with falling debris or a large shooting star. Rothany Observatory released a photo of a light blue teardrop lighting up most of the night sky. So there you go. I just missed this fireball, which flashed across the Calgary sky. I know we've got people listening right now that live in Calgary. So if you happen to have been there and seen this fireball late Tuesday night, let me know. 855-478-4478. If you'd like to call in, that is 855-478-4478. And also this is interesting because somebody had posted this on our message board on the wrestling website. We have a world news section, and somebody posted this in there, and I thought it was kind of amazing because this seems like a gigantic story that would interest folks from this website and the Dark Matter Radio Network. But in looking around at various websites that cover this sort of news, I did not see this anywhere, which really surprises me. By the way, if you go to AfterDarkRadioShow.com, if you move over to the left-hand side of the page, you can see a bunch of very interesting stories from unexplained-mysteries.com. If this was on here, I did not see it. But this got a lot of press over the last couple of days. This is from the New York Post. It says here, solar flare nearly destroyed the Earth 2 years ago, says NASA. That's right. It nearly destroyed the Earth. It says here, 2 years ago, we were all going about our daily business, blissfully unaware that our planet almost plunged into global catastrophe. A recent revelation by NASA explains how on July 23rd, 2012, isn't that interesting, Earth had a near miss with a solar flare or a coronal mass ejection from the most powerful storm on the sun in over 150 years, but nobody decided to mention it. That's a sobering bit of news. Daniel Baker of the University of Colorado says, if it had hit, we would still be picking up the pieces. 2 years later, by the way. And we managed to just avoid the event through lucky timing as the sun's aim narrowly turned away from Earth. Had it occurred a week earlier when it was pointing at us, the result could have been frighteningly different. Baker says, I have come away from our recent studies more convinced than ever that Earth and its inhabitants were incredibly fortunate that the 2012 eruption happened when it did. If the eruption had occurred only 1 week earlier, the Earth would have been in the line of fire. The power of this ejection could have raced across space to knock us back to the Dark Ages. It is believed that a direct CME hit would have the potential to wipe out communication networks, GPS, and electrical grids to cause widespread blackout. The article goes on to say it would disable everything that plugs into a wall socket. Most people would not even be able to flush their toilet because urban water supplies largely rely on electric pumps. It says just 10 minutes without electricity, internet, or communication across the globe is a scary thought, and the effects of an event like this could last years. It would be chaos and disaster on an epic scale. According to a study by the National Academy of Sciences, the total economic impact would exceed $2 trillion, 20 times greater than the cost of a Hurricane Katrina. Multi-ton transformers damaged by such a storm might take years to repair. So can we breathe a worldwide sigh of relief? Physicist Pete Riley says that the odds of a solar storm strong enough to disrupt our lives coming in the next 10 years is 12 6%. Initially, he says, I was quite surprised that the odds were so high, but the statistics appear to be correct. It is a sobering figure. However, it says the CME that almost battered us was a bit of a freak occurrence, as it had actually been two ejections within 10 minutes of each other, plus a previous CME had happened 4 days earlier to effectively clear the path. And the article concludes, sleep well, everybody. Think about that. We could have had, if it had been 1 week difference, there would have been a worldwide potential disaster that would have hit us in the year 2012. You know, what's funny is I just heard about this like yesterday, I believe. And when we were in Calgary, we went to a used bookstore, and they've always got the, I can't remember what they call the section. I think they used to call it a cult. I'm not sure what they called it here in this bookstore. I remember when I was a little kid, I always wanted books on UFOs and Bigfoot, but I hated going over to that section called occult. I just felt, I don't know, occult seemed to me to be like witchcraft. And I didn't like being in a section where people would come by and think I was looking at books about witchcraft. And I was really just wanting to see a book about Bigfoot and UFOs. But anyway, so I'm in this bookstore, and it's a used bookstore. And so I go over to the occult area, and it's one book after another about 2012. And I was just like, man, these books are never going to sell. You may as well take these off the shelves. But there you go, 2012, we nearly had a worldwide disaster. Think about that. And speaking of disaster, Los Angeles awaits the earthquake that could be the big one. This from July 19th. In the UK Telegraph, a megaquake in America's second most populous city is long overdue, and 50-year-old buildings could come crashing down, it says, killing thousands. Next year, residents of Los Angeles will flock to cinemas to see a blockbuster called San Andreas, in which their city will be wiped out by an apocalyptic earthquake. Kylie Minogue and Dwayne The Rock Johnson, there's your wrestling tie-in, one of Hollywood's current most bankable stars, actually the second highest-grossing movie star of the year, Dwayne The Rock Johnson. He will be seen roaming the wreckage after the city of L.A. is mercilessly flattened by the big one. As skyscrapers collapse, thousands die, chaos ensues, and most of those in the audience will be wondering how long before it happens for real. The southern section of the San Andreas Fault that runs near the city has not had a megaquake of more than magnitude 7.5 since 1680. That's right, everybody, 1680. And according to seismologists, it is more than a century overdue. That is not good. A flurry of lesser earthquakes in recent months has refocused attention on whether America's second city can withstand a major hit. In the first 5 months of this year, there were 5 quakes of more than magnitude 4.0, the first time that has happened since 1994, sending jitters through the city. A big earthquake is inevitable, said Dr. Lucy Jones. Each earthquake that happens increases the probability. We know a lot about earthquakes. We know it will happen. We know everything but the time. It says here Dr. Jones is worried. And when she worries, everyone else should as well. What is particularly keeping her up at night is the number of old concrete buildings that have not been retrofitted and could topple or collapse inwardly into a pancake. The expensive retrofitting process involves reinforcing buildings, for example, with steel braces. As she says that LA was built in the 50s and 60s, and all the buildings from that time have some real problems. According to a recent study by the University of California, there are about 1,451 concrete buildings in LA that have not been retrofitted. And that includes 50 hotels, 50 churches, and 25 nursing homes. It has been estimated that in a large earthquake, 5% of these, about 75 in total, could collapse, and it is not, it cannot be predicted which ones. So that is not good. When I read stories like this, I really think about Am I prepared? Do I have water? Do I have canned food? I've never been one of those guys that has just been sort of like, I gotta make sure that I stock up on canned food. I gotta make sure I've got water here. I've gotta have a disaster preparedness kit. Never been one of those people. And in my lifetime, I've never needed to be. But sometimes you read these articles. I don't live in LA, but I do live in Seattle, and there has been a lot of talk that Seattle may be expecting a big one. So it does kind of make you think when you think about all of this stuff with the solar flares, and you think about wherever you live. I know that different places around the world. I mean, you've got obvious natural disasters that occur. You know, depending on where you live, you may get hurricanes, you may get tornadoes, you may get snow. You know, you should be prepared. And the weather out here in Seattle is usually it's pretty tame. You know, we may get a little bit of snow during the winter, but it melts fairly quickly. We're never really snowed in. Although in 2008, we were absolutely, the snow just destroyed this place. And the problem with Seattle is we don't have any snow plows because we don't get a lot of snow. And so we had one year where it snowed like crazy. It never got above freezing. It snowed again. And it was wild, all of the snow that we had here. And that was a bad year. But, if you think about some of these things that could befall you, we're not just talking about a couple of days of snow here. We're talking about a solar flare wiping things out for years. Or the disaster that would befall if a giant earthquake hit the Seattle metropolitan area or L.A., and it'd be a complete disaster. So something to think about. Might want to look up on the internet some information about disaster preparedness, have some canned food available just in case, some water. I don't know particularly how crazy a person has to go, but it is better safe than sorry. This from Avoxi.com, V-O-X-X-I.com. The Vatican is ready to make a statement on extraterrestrial life. For decades, the Vatican has convened some of the brightest minds in the scientific community around the world to ponder the possibility of extraterrestrial life and to prepare a public disclosure on behalf of the Catholic Church in case the existence of aliens is confirmed. And many scientists affirm we're not far from establishing first contact, given the advances made in astronomy. Because of this, the Vatican wishes to be ready with a statement. Might not be an easy task for the church to interpret Holy Scripture. If life is found on other planets and man is not the only creature, it turns out, made in the image of God. This past March, the Vatican University and the University of Arizona organized a conference held in Tucson to discuss the advances made in the search for extraterrestrial life. The conference was inspired by the rapid discovery of planets, new findings on the thresholds of extreme conditions at which life on planet Earth can survive, and new technology designed for the search of life on exoplanets. So essentially, they have created some sort of statement that they have, that they have already prepared, and they are holding out. Details of the statement that the Vatican is working on have not been revealed publicly. There is a Vatican observatory. Maybe they have discovered something that the rest of us don't know about. I would guess that if they had seen something or had some sort of information, it would have gotten out, but there are always conspiracy theories. What is going on in the Vatican? Have they seen anything in the Vatican Observatory? What do they have in the Vatican Library? I'd like to do a show, actually, on the Vatican someday. Maybe we'll try and set up a guest to talk about that. A lot of interesting things going on in the Vatican. I got a lot of other news stories here, but I'm going to save them for after the interview. I should note again that tonight's interview with Thierry Legault, Thierry does live in France, and so we had to use Skype to conduct this interview. I am not a big fan of Skype. I try to avoid Skype whenever I can. If you've got two people with a great wired connection, then Skype normally sounds great. But if you've got somebody who may not have a good connection, or maybe there's internet issues, you know, one way or the other, Skyping France, we're Skyping France here. So there are some issues with the call quality here and there. Because it was a taped interview, I was able to go back and edit out a lot of the problems. So hopefully, most of this you won't even notice. But there are a couple of Skype issues here and there, so bear with us. The big issues are in the first 10 minutes or so. After that, it's pretty much smooth sailing. Thierry has a very French accent. He is very French. So listen carefully. He's got a lot of really, really great information. And as noted, if you want to check out his website as you're listening to the interview, you can go to www.astrophoto.fr. That is www.astrophoto.fr. A lot of the photographs I'll be talking about are up there on that page, so go up there and check it out. It's a very, very cool page, and he's got a lot of very interesting stories and a lot of interesting things to talk about. So we're going to head to that interview with Thierry Legault from France. So that's coming up in just a moment. We'll be back in a moment with Thierry here on After Dark Radio on the Dark Matter Broadcasting Network. Here on After Dark Radio, Brian Alvarez here, Dark Matter Radio Network. We are very happy today to be joined by Thierry Legault, who is an amazing photographer. If you've never heard of Thierry, you should probably just Google his name. You can check out his website, which has all sorts of awesome photographs we're going to be talking about today. And Thierry, how you doing?
I'm very well, and I'm very happy to be with you tonight.
You're out there in France, is that correct?
Yes, I'm in France, and it's 11 p.m. now.
11 p.m. Hey, that's what time we air here in the U.S. as well, so very good. First question, yeah. For those of you, for those listening that don't know anything about Thierry Legault, tell everybody a little bit about yourself and how you got into photography.
Oh, I went to photography by astronomy. At the beginning, when I was a small teenager, a child, I was interested in science. I read some science magazine. And I remember I was 13 or 14. I saw a magazine about astronomy, and there was a section about amateur astronomers, and they show telescopes. It was in the 70s, so, you know, now people have a lot of telescopes available in many shops, but in the 70s, there were very, very few telescopes, and they were expensive. And I dreamt looking at those small telescopes, and I asked my parents to buy one for my birthday, and that's what they did. And I remember it was in the early morning before sunrise in the winter, and I turned my very small telescope, a small refractor, towards Saturn, and I saw for the first time the rings of Saturn, and it was amazing. And I had to go to school just after, but I didn't want to go to school. I wanted to stay looking at Saturn, and that was the beginning of my passion for astronomy.
That's kind of funny, because you're described as an amateur astronomy photographer, but I mean you have your work has been featured on CNN. You've taken photographs that literally nobody has ever taken photographs like this before. You've got a photograph taken from Earth of an astronaut on the space station, if I recall correctly. And I think you took a photograph of a new moon, the earliest photo ever of a new moon, just a very tiny sliver. And your work has just been seen all over the world. And I mean, when you were a little kid, I mean, did you ever think, man, someday I'm going to be doing these things that nobody has ever done before?
It's not my job. So I do the advantage of having a hobby like that is that I do what I want when I want. I don't have to do that for a living. It came little by little. And what I like now in astrophotography is kind of challenge. I am looking for a new challenge every time. It's not so easy to find and to realize. I like the challenge. I like preparing and doing things that have never been done before.
Now, tell everybody a little bit about the photograph you took of the astronomer outside the space station. Apparently, somebody had attempted to take one before, but it was very, very blurry. And yours is the first ever where it's very clear that this is an astronaut.
Actually, it came little by little, a little by chance, because in 2006, I wrote a book about astrophotography, in French, of course, and I didn't want to use picture of other people. I wanted to realize all pictures of the book. And so I took picture of everything, the planets, the moon, the galaxies, everything. And I wanted to take a picture of the space station in front of the sun, passing in front of the sun. And then I continued to do that. And probably the first, the most famous one was during the just after the launch of the space shuttle, 24 hours before launch of the last servicing mission for space telescope, and I photographed the space shuttle just the day after launch, passing in front of the sun, and they have been a little bit frustrated because I could take a picture of the space station passing in front of the sun as a silhouette, but I couldn't take it passing in the night sky. So taking very detailed picture with the solar panels, all the modules, etc. And I contacted someone who became a friend and with an electronician, and we worked together. Or he worked more than me, actually, much more. But we worked together to modify very deeply a telescope and to make it able to track the space station or any other satellite. So basically, it has two cameras, one camera for taking the main picture and a second camera on a second telescope. There are two telescopes side by side. And the second camera locks on a bright object and orders the speed of the motors to track automatically the target. And so it took 2 years to develop and to build this system, which is quite unique in the world. I think that U.S. Army have such things, but I'm sure that, for example, French Army don't have that. I began to take videos of the space station and other kind of satellites. I also took spy satellites, for example. And I remember I especially wanted to, in 2011, especially wanted to take a video of space shuttle docked. As you know, now the space shuttle is retired. And so it was one of the last missions. And I took this video on the space shuttle docked to the space station. And when I processed the video, I remarked something very strange. A kind of arm, and at the end of the arm there was a very small dot, which was an astronaut. And so I was very happy. I was very surprised to get this astronaut. And to take this picture, I drove a lot because the sky was cloudy over France, as it is very often. Yeah, France is not California, you know, so I have to fight against the weather very often. And I went to East Germany with my car and with all the telescope in my van, and to take this picture. But I didn't regret all the distance as I drive.
You've got, I want to direct everybody, if they have not seen it, to the website, which is astrophoto.fr. That's astrophoto.fr, and I'll tweet that out as well. There are so many awesome photos on the very first page, in fact. You mentioned the space shuttle. You've got a shot here, the Discovery, taken from Earth. I mean, all of these are, here's the Endeavour and the ISS going in front of the sun. An amazing photograph, a photo of the sun, and you can actually see the space shuttle and the Hubble telescope photographed in front of the sun. And I guess, of all of these photographs, which one were you just the most amazed that you got a shot of?
This is difficult to say. Perhaps my preferred is the space shuttle alone in front of the sun, just after launch. It's probably my preferred set of picture, because it was really a very nice adventure. I took those pictures with the space shuttle and the Hubble Space Telescope in front of the sun from Florida, because I attended to the launch of the space shuttle, and it was amazing. You know, I was on the press site of the Kennedy Space Center, and it was really an amazing launch. And the day after, as I told you, I took the space shuttle in front of the sun. I had a lot of success, and the day after, the space shuttle and the Hubble Space Telescope together in front of the sun. And so it was really a fantastic souvenir.
There's also a number of pictures here at astrophoto.fr of the International Space Station. And I should note also that in addition to photographing all of this stuff, you also are known for photographing spy satellites. Is that correct?
Oh yes, I am. As I told you, I am. We have built a telescope that can follow any bright in the sky, and so spy satellites are very interesting because they are big and they are bright, and most of them are at low altitude, so we can get some kind of details. Typically, their altitude is between 300 and 600 kilometers, so it's not so far. It's much closer than geostationary satellites like Meteosat, for example. So spy satellites, especially American spy satellites, are very big. I got some details on them, and it's quite funny to spy the spy, you know, even if I don't reveal any secret, you know. It's just a picture taken from the ground, but it's really funny. I do it again for the challenge.
Now, obviously, as you said, you're not revealing any secrets, but has anybody ever come to you and just said, you know, Thierry, let's stop photographing our spy satellites here?
No, for the moment, I have seen no men in black knocking to my door.
That's good. Hopefully it stays that way. You've got a great photograph that I've seen of it is you got a lot of them of things taken against the backdrop of the sun, and there's a great photo of, I guess it's Venus, passing in front of the sun, and in the same photograph where you can see Venus, you can also see is it Hubble that's passing the sun at the same time?
Yes, that's true. It's the Hubble. It's a very very small dot. Because, you know, the distance of Hubble at that moment was about 700 or 800 kilometers. So it's the size of a bus. Hubble is the size of a bus. So, you know, it's difficult to get some details. But I got that. I like very much to travel to take the pictures. I travel a lot for my job, and I also travel a lot for astronomy. I like that very much, and it was the occasion in 2012 to go to Australia, because the transit of Venus was visible in totality from Australia. So I never visited Australia, so it was a good occasion. I stayed 3 weeks in this magnificent country, visiting different places, and I went exactly to the place where I was in the bush. There was nobody and nothing around me with a four-wheel drive car. And I stopped in a place where I knew that I would see the transit of Venus and at a moment of the Hubble Space Telescope.
Now,
I just wanted to see this transit of Venus because there have been one transit of Venus in 2004, this transit of Venus in 2012, and the next transit of Venus will appear next century.
Wow.
2117.
So this was literally a once-in-a-lifetime experience.
Exactly. Yeah.
Oh, okay, so that actually begs the question here. Are there any once-in-a-lifetime celestial moments that you are aware of that maybe you are preparing far in advance to be there when it happens to photograph it?
I also often travel to see a solar eclipse, total eclipse.
Mm-hmm.
I have traveled, for example, two times to Angola, to Egypt, Siberia, China, to look at eclipses. And probably I will try to see the next eclipse but a very interesting one in 2017 in United States. And the path will cross the whole United States from west to east, and it will be certainly a magnificent eclipse. But an eclipse, it's very, it's really something very nice to see, but it's not what I would say a once-in-a-lifetime experience. Probably such things happened to me in 1994, when a comet crashed on Jupiter.
That's right.
And it was really a unique event. And I have the chance to be invited in a big observatory in France called the Pic du Midi. It's quite famous in the world. Mm. It's very high in the mountains, and it's a very old and famous observatory. And I had the chance to be invited in this observatory for this occasion, and we took picture of Jupiter with dark spots, which were all the the pieces of the comet falling on Jupiter, and it was a crazy week. You know, we couldn't believe what we saw on the screen of the computer. We began to to take the picture with a digital camera, even in 1994. Long time before digital camera were available for everyone, the astronomers were the first, probably the first people using digital sensor. I had my first digital sensor in 1993, and it was very, very small sensor with only 500,000 pixels and very, very expensive. But it was, really the beginning of a revolution. It's in astronomy, a digital sensor compared to film is really a revolution. Like the same thing happened from visual to photography. So, and I have been very happy to live this revolution.
So that was Shoemaker-Levy, correct?
Shoemaker-Levy 9, yes.
Now, when you were here on Earth watching this comet crash into Jupiter, I mean, first off, I feel so old because it doesn't seem like it was that long ago, but that was a long time ago. I mean, were you just kind of thinking, man, if something like that happens to this planet, we're done for?
If that happened to the Earth, perhaps we wouldn't be there to discuss about that.
That's right.
We don't know, but fortunately, Jupiter is a kind of guardian or protector for the Earth a little bit, because it's a very big planet. As you know, it's the biggest planet of the solar system, and so it protects a little bit the inner solar system from those those dangerous objects. But nevertheless, the risk exists. to get some some piece of comet or asteroid in the future. But I hope that it won't be tomorrow.
So going back to the eclipse in 2017, are you saying that I live in Seattle? Are you saying that from Seattle, Washington, all the way to New York, everybody in the country should be able to see this eclipse?
Oh, yes. I don't remember exactly the path. We have to look on the internet. But as if I remember correctly, it goes from northwest of the United States, so probably not very far from Seattle, across Grand Teton National Park, mm-hmm. just south of Yellowstone. I was in Yellowstone last year, and it's fantastic place. And going to, I think, the central east coast, not south of New York, but north of Florida. I don't remember exactly where. And, you know, the width of the path is several tens of kilometers. So you have to be inside the totality path, because if you are outside, it's just a partial eclipse. And, okay, a partial eclipse is nice, but really a total eclipse is something completely different, because you have the darkness, you can see the brightest planets, and it's something, you know, that looks really supernatural. If you never attended to a total eclipse, I really encourage you to go in the totality path, and don't try to take photos. Don't lose time with your camera. Many people will take photos. Now, I take very few photos for eclipse. I just watch, because it lasts 2 or 3 minutes. So it's very, very short. And now I have to enjoy all the vision I have of the eclipse. It's, as I said, it's really something kind of supernatural, like polar auroras or northern lights, which is also something. I was in Norway in January, and I filmed. I was just processing the video, and I was in Norway for filming in real time polar auroras, and it's also something that is incredible. And I will go again to Norway in October, and probably once again in January or February. Because, you know, it's like total eclipse. With polar auroras, you become addicted to that.
That's right. Yeah, it's funny. I read an article that was talking about how nowadays it seems that people are having less memories of places that they go to, because everybody has a phone on their camera, and they're so busy taking photographs of everything that they're not actually looking at everything. And that's actually a really good point. I mean, if you get a chance to see an eclipse, there's going to be plenty of pictures that other people have taken of this eclipse. You should probably just sit there and enjoy it for the 3 minutes.
Yes, exactly. I remember my first real nice eclipse. It was in 2001 in Angola. And I took a lot of pictures. And at the end, I say, okay, what did I see? Nothing. Just a screen of the camera.
That's right.
And it was very frustrating. So now I continue to take pictures, but I have an automated sequence on the camera. So I launch the sequence with different exposure time, etc., different setting, and I let the camera run automatically. And I just look. I take binoculars or very small telescopes. I just enjoy looking, because, you know, no photograph in the world can give you the view of the sun during an eclipse, and the corona of the sun, which is kind of atmosphere of the sun in a sense, mm-hmm. that appears only during eclipse. It's only during eclipse that we see the solar corona, and the corona is like something very difficult to describe. It's so beautiful. It's kind of bright and kind of metallic, silver, transparent and bright, and it's impossible to describe, and it's really impossible to photograph.
Now, you mentioned in 1994, you were one of the first people that had the opportunity to use digital cameras. And obviously, nowadays, everybody's got a digital camera. What kind of advances have there been in technology, and what kind of advances are coming? Are we entering a time where maybe 10 years from now, the photographs that you take today, you'll kind of look back on and go, man, look what I can do now?
I hope so. I hope so. I'm not sure. I'm, as you know, I'm not an astrologer, so I will not predict the future. Anyway, they are unable all the time to predict the future.
Sure.
But I hope that the sensor on the camera will continue to progress. I'm not sure because, you know, we came from the film era, where what we call the quantum efficiency, the quantity of light that is really transformed into a signal, and the efficiency of the film was a few percent only, and now we have sensors that have an efficiency between 50 and 90% of efficiency. So of course, we cannot exceed 100% of efficiency. So we are now not at the perfect sensor, but we are not so far from what we could call a kind of perfect sensor. So I'm not sure they will continue to progress at the same speed. But nevertheless, the tools we have now are so efficient. When I compare the picture we take now, and I compare them to the picture that were taken in the 70s or even in the 80s by the biggest telescope in the world, there is no possible comparison. It's another planet.
Yeah, I'm looking at a picture you've taken of the surface of the moon, and beautiful picture. I mean, it's so detailed. And I mean, I think back to when we first had probes go into Mars, and they would take pictures of the Martian surface, and everybody would see faces and all this sort of thing. And then you get better cameras, and all of a sudden it's like, yep, that's a mountain right there. And this picture you've got of the moon, it's just it's so detailed. I know you've got pictures of Mercury, like the surface of Mercury. It's pretty amazing.
Yes, yes. For the planets, now we have very efficient sensor, and we have also a very efficient processing. For planets especially, processing is very, very efficient. Typically, for images of the moon or the planet, we don't take single pictures. Because of the seeing, what we call the turbulence, that blurs all the image. So when we want to take very detailed picture of the planet, we use a video camera. For the moon, we use a black and white video camera with the black and white sensor, because with the moon, we don't need color image. The moon is colorless. And we take thousands of pictures, thousands of frames in the videos. We take videos during 1 minute, 2 minutes, 5 minutes, 10 minutes. And at 30 or 60 frames per second, we get 1,000 or even 10,000 pictures, and then we put those videos in special design and made by astronomers, and they automatically select the best frames, the best 100 frames, let's say, of the series, the ones that are affected by turbulence, and these very sharp images are combined to increase their quality by the software. They are registered, combined, distorted, and then it gives the final result. So it's really this software tools help us to take the best from the condition, from the telescope, and from the atmospheric conditions of the night.
Now, obviously, there are, since we mentioned some of the Mars photos, I mean, there are people who believe that there are strange things on the surface of the moon and on Mars. And, I mean, if anybody would know, it would probably be you, since you've taken so many of these amazing photographs. I mean, do you ever see anomalies or largely if you see something weird in a frame, it's likely something that you can point to the software or some sort of a glitch in the photograph.
Oh, sometimes we got some strange things on the picture, but every time we can explain them finally by either a sensor defect. Or sometimes we have cosmic rays crossing the sensor and making a kind of bright dot or bright line. Or it may be a reflection inside the telescope or inside the camera. So sometimes we see strange things, but everything is explainable by natural or by a camera or processing artifact. Sometimes I see, now processing software is so powerful that you just have to click with the mouse. It's so easy that people go too far in processing. And when you go too far in processing, you can create noise and artifacts. And I have seen a lot of times people that that go too far with processing, and they create things that don't exist.
So essentially, you would have you would have a photograph, let's say, of the moon, and it's not the best photo, and so you try and process it clearer, and then you try and go further and further and further, and eventually you go so far that, hey, there's a grid pattern there that you someone would claim, oh, that these are walls or whatever. But in reality, it's just an overprocessed photo.
Yes, yes. These processing tools, as I said, are very powerful, but they can do very good things, but no miracles. When we take the picture at the telescope, the raw image must be good, and that means a good telescope with good adjustments of the mirrors, with good focusing. There is no autofocus in astronomy, so we have to focus manually, and good settings and etc. So there are a lot of parameters to master. And not to say about atmospheric turbulence. And against turbulence, we just have our patience to benefit from the best nights that are very rare. But processing is here to show what is good in the image. But if there is nothing good in the image because of problems at shooting, it's like Jigo or Geigo. It's garbage in, garbage out. That's mm-hmm. the principle of processing.
You've got, and we've talked about stuff inside our solar system, but you've got shots here on your website of nebula, galaxies, comets. Some of these pictures are just beautiful of the galaxies and such. I mean, what do you prefer of photographing? I mean, do you love going out there and getting a chance to see, like, something crossing the plane of the sun, or do you love taking the photographs of various galaxies? What is your favorite thing to take photos of?
It depends on the moment. I like changing. So sometimes I have periods with deep sky, what we call deep sky, which is comets, galaxies, etc. Sometimes more the planets, sometimes more the sun. You know, I change my mood and what I want to do. For example, last month or 3 weeks ago, I was in Indonesia. And I took picture of the sky with just a camera on a tripod. I stayed all the night in front of volcanoes with the smoke over the two volcanoes. So before this talk, I was beginning to process a time lapse of the sky rotation just over the volcanoes. And it was an amazing night, alone and with the sky, the Milky Way, and the Indonesian volcanoes in activity just in front of me. So I hope that the time lapse will be ready next month. There is a lot of work, and I hope that it will be not too bad.
You do have some awesome photos from here on Earth. I'm looking at a picture that you took in Australia. You talked about that trip. The Wallaman Falls, which is, this picture is, I don't even know how to describe it. You've got the Milky Way, you've got what appears to be a meteor, you've got a waterfall, and you've got what I guess is not a rainbow, but it is a moonbow because it is taken at night and the moon's illumination created that rainbow. Is that correct?
Exactly. It was a night of a full moon, so the sky is very blue, because as you know, the sky during the day is blue because of the light of the sun, but when there is a full moon also, the sky is also blue, very dark blue, of course, but the photo reveals this blue. So here we have a moon bow, we have the light of the moon, and we have no rain, but it's the waterfall. So it's the same kind of course that makes this rainbow. But it was very, very... Actually, I didn't see the moon bow with the naked eye. I saw it on the photo.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Interesting. So you couldn't see it, but it showed up in the photograph.
Yes, because the light of the moon was so bright.
I see.
The moon bow was not very bright. So perhaps I could see it, but it was very, very difficult.
What are some of your other photos that maybe I haven't had a chance to check out, but we can go up to your website and check out astrophoto.fr. What are some of the other cool photographs that you've taken from here on Earth?
Oh, as I said, I love taking pictures and looking at polar auroras. I have put a time lapse in my website, taken in Norway in 2012, and I have another time lapse, but not yet finished, from Norway too, with real time polar aurora. So it's very amazing thing, because we never know how they will be and when they will appear, disappear, the shape, the brightness they will show. It's really every time it's really a surprise, and it's something very very impressive.
Now, this is After Dark Radio. We have a lot of people calling in and such with conspiracy theories and the like, and of course there are a group of people that believe that man never stepped foot on the moon, that it was some sort of elaborate hoax. Have you ever had an opportunity to photograph any of the actual landing sites to confirm to yourself that, in fact, we did go there?
Oh, no, unfortunately, the moon is too far, and these artifacts, human artifacts, are too small. So even the biggest telescope on the Earth is not able to get picture of those the lunar module or the lunar jeep, for example.
Sure.
So it's impossible to take them from Earth. Nevertheless, we have picture of them, because there is a small, very small satellite, a small probe called LRO, Lunar Reconnaissance Orbiter, that have been launched a few years ago, and that orbits the moon very, very close to the surface. I think less than 100 kilometers of altitude. And this probe took picture of the different Apollo sites, and we see, I think it's very very amazing to see that traces 40 years ago, more than 40 years ago, we see the lunar module, and we even see the traces of the jeep, and when I look at those pictures, I was 7 years old in 1969, so I have very little memory of that, even if at home we already have the television, but it's difficult for me to remember. But it's really amazing to see again those modules and traces on the moon. So for me, I'm sure at 100% because of all this evidence that people went to the moon, really.
Now, you mentioned that before, or I guess to get into astrophotography, you had first been into astronomy, and you'd gotten that first telescope, and you were so excited to see the rings of Saturn. I mean, what are some of the things that maybe your average person doesn't think about in terms of the wonders of the universe? I mean, for example, the fact that you see a total solar eclipse because the moon is exactly the right distance to completely cover the sun, which I just find amazing. And we never see one side of the moon because it rotates at such a... I guess it rotates in such a manner that we only see one side of it. I mean, there's so many amazing things about the universe. What are some other things that maybe people have never thought about that you've just found fascinating?
Oh, there are. What is also very interesting in this activity is that most people never look above, never look at the sky. They always look and on the ground or everything around them, but they don't. Very often don't look at the sky. And when they look at it, they see a lot of things. Very often, at least once per month, I show to friends or to colleagues the space station passing in the sky or different satellites. And each time they say, no, this can't be the space station. I say, yes, this is the space station. And this is very bright. And this is very easy to see if you just... look at it, look at the sky. And when I begin to discuss with the people, they have a lot of questions, and especially many questions about the distances in the universe, the distance of the moon, the planets, of the nearest stars or the galaxy. And when we begin to talk about that, people are really, really, really interested, and they have a lot of questions. And they realize that astronomy is a kind of science, of course, but it can also be a hobby, and it's not very difficult. We don't need to be a doctor in astrophysics to understand how the universe works, and there are many, many things very simple and very pleasant to learn and to look at in the sky.
I think that a lot of people live in big cities, and so it's harder to see. But I don't know if there's really anywhere in the world where you can't drive maybe a half hour or so, an hour at the most, and be somewhere where you can get a pretty good look at the sky. Would you say that's correct, or would some people have to travel further?
Yes, I agree with you. I agree. When people are in holidays, sometimes in the mountains or in close to deserts, now at that moment they say, oh, I see the sky. I have never seen such a sky with the Milky Way. And it's a pity because what we call light pollution is developing everywhere. We astronomers see the light pollution as a kind of prison. People are in a prison of light, and that prevents them to see beyond this prison of light. And when they are outside this prison of light, they can see the nature, they can see the sky with the Milky Way, the shooting stars, and everything, all the beauties of the sky.
Now, I think in mid-August, we've always got at least, I know here, it's like August 15th, 16th, is it the Perseids, or what is the meteor shower in mid-August every year?
Yes, we have a meteor shower, and it's one of the best meteor shower in the year, and especially interesting because it's in summer, so people can go outside and look at the meteors. So it's a very very nice to see. You just take a chair and you lie on the grass and just looking at the sky. We need no telescope, no camera, just looking at the shooting star, and it's very very good and quiet activity. The reason is that each year crosses the orbit of a comet called the comet Swift-Tuttle, and so it's the comet that lets on its trajectory very little dust or particles of stone that finally hit the Earth and make this kind of shooting star, which is not a star, of course, which is a very, very small dust particle.
So that's it is the Perseids. It will be August 10th through 13th, which is the best time to see them. So yes. if you can get out of the light pollution, head out there and check them out.
Yes, exactly. It's light pollution again is the first enemy, and of course the clouds also are the enemy of astronomers. But light pollution is a big problem to see the meteors and the Perseids. Yes.
Well, I live in Seattle, so I got a lot of cloud pollution. But luckily, during August, it's usually pretty clear. Now, before we go, I mean, I just wanted to ask you a little bit about your you and maybe what kind of future goals you have. I mean, are there certain things that just sort of are life goals for you, that you want to photograph this or you want to get a shot of that? I mean, do you have goals, or you just kind of see where the technology goes and just try to do better every time with each of your photos?
Yes, that's it. I let the things come, and the ideas sometimes come. Currently, I'm very, as I said, very focused on polar auroras, and perhaps in 2 or 3 years, I don't know, something else, but I don't know yet.
And any final words for people? I know that you've been into astronomy your whole life, and obviously, we talked a little bit about the meteor showers and just getting out there and kind of laying down. Are there good resources? I mean, obviously, your website is one of them. But I mean, are there good resources that people can check out to find out when they can see certain things on certain nights?
Yes. There is a very good site that is called Space Weather, spaceweather.com, which warns for all events and show a lot of very nice photos of events. For example, last new moon was the super moon, called the super moon because it was quite, the moon was a bit closer than usual. So we have a lot of photos of this called super moon. And the spaceweather.com is a very, 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 very good site. We also have a website called Heavens Above that displays the next passages of the space station or the brightest satellites. So if ever you have ever seen the space station, it's very bright, so you can see it even from the center of the city. No problem with that. It's even brighter than the brightest planet. It's very, very funny to see it pass, and it passes quite often in the sky of cities like Seattle.
So spaceweather.com, you can head up there. The page I'm looking at right now, there's actually a really cool photo that somebody took from an airplane. It is essentially a rainbow, but it's in the shape of a heart. Amazing photograph. But there's all sorts of great photos up there at spaceweather.com. And our guest today, Thierry Legault, you can check out his website at astrophoto.fr. And there's so many great photos up there. You can check out constellations and rotations, galaxies, comets, and of course pictures of the moon, the sun, and so much other stuff. So it's a great website. Make sure you check that out. And Thierry, I want to thank you so much for doing the show today, and best of luck with everything.
Thank you very much.
And thank you so much, everybody. We'll be back in just a moment with more After Dark Radio on the Dark Matter Broadcasting Network. And we are back here on the show, everybody. Brian Alvarez here, After Dark Radio, Dark Matter Radio Network. Thierry Legault was our guest, and for more information on Thierry, you can check out his website, which we talked about on the program, which is astrophoto.fr. That is astrophoto.fr. A lot of really cool photos up there if you haven't had a chance to check them out yet. A lot of really good stuff, so head up there to astrophoto.fr and check out all of his work, and if you really like it, as noted, he has got a He's got a great book called Astrophotography, which is available in English as of this month, actually. July 2014 is available in English. You can get 40% off the book if you use the code Astrophoto, and you can pre-order at O'Reilly. What is O'Reilly? Well, if you head up to astrophoto.fr, there is a link to that, and you can head up there and check that out. All right, for the next 45 minutes, we are going to do news here, as well as take your phone calls and emails, as well as Twitter questions. How do you contact the program? Well, if you head up to the website afterdarkradioshow.com, all of the information is up there. We've got the phone number 855-478-4478. If you'd like to call us toll-free in the U.S. and Canada, that is 855-478-4478. You can contact us via Twitter at Brian Alvarez. You can follow the live show feed over there on the AfterDarkRadioShow.com page. And if you'd like to contact us via email, Brian@WrestlingObserver.com is the email address. You can check it out there. So give us a call, drop us an email, or tweet us. Let us know what is on your mind. Any topics? I don't know, maybe you've watched some programming lately. I don't know if you've been watching Finding Bigfoot. I know they've had some rather interesting shows on of late. So if you've got topics, you've got many, many topics you can talk about here on this program. It is, as noted, open lines. All right, this here from unexplained-mysteries.com. Less than 10% of our DNA has a functional role. Scientists now believe that over 90% of our DNA may be little more than biological baggage. I'm not sure what the I forget what the name of the movie is. They've been doing all sorts of commercials for it lately, but it's the big tagline is that people only use 10% of their brain, and this particular woman has gotten the ability to use more than 10% of her brain, and so she's got all of these powers. Which is what brought me to this article here. The usage of 10% of your brain is actually a myth. It is not true that we only use 10% of our brain, which does in fact lead me to a little bit of skepticism here about this this claim that only 10% of our DNA has a functional role. It says there is a common myth that we only use 10% of our brains, but when it comes to our DNA, this claim may actually be true. New research conducted by scientists at Oxford University has revealed that a large percentage of the DNA in our bodies may be evolutionary leftovers that serve little purpose. This guy here, Gerton Lunter, says, scientifically speaking, we have no evidence that 92% of our genome is contributing to our biology at all. A full 92%. The 8.2% of our DNA that is considered functional is that part that plays a sufficiently important role to be conserved by evolution. Now, I don't know. I'm not a geneticist or anything like that. But the idea that 90% of our DNA is biological baggage, I don't know if I believe that or if I believe that maybe we just have not figured out what a large percentage of this DNA is used for, what it's about, what it stores. I think that's perhaps more likely than the idea that that we only use 10%. Maybe we've only figured out what 10% of it is for, but there is actually a usage for the rest of that. Also, this here, one of my favorite topics of conversation is animals. Speaking, maybe not speaking, but interspecies communication, I guess, is the best way to put it. If you've got a pet, you probably, I read an article, I can't remember where it was, I don't have it in front of me, but it was talking about, you know, your dog, and it said that your dog probably understands a lot of what you say. Now, I don't know exactly what that means. What does it mean that my dog knows a lot about what I say? Does that mean that, you know, if I say treat enough times, the dog will understand what the word treat means? Is that what that means? I don't know. But, you know, I'm certain that my cats understand a fair number of words. And by fair, I mean maybe 24. They certainly can't speak. We don't communicate. But they know the word dinner. They know snack. They know paper. They know toy. You know, you say these words. If I say toy, they know to run to the closet where the toys are. If I say dinner, they know to run upstairs to where they get fed. If I say paper, they come running because they know I'm going to throw a piece of paper. And if I say bug, they'll run to the window and they'll look outside because that's where the bugs are. So they know these words, but it's not like we can communicate. I'm not like claiming to communicate with my cats, but I'm sure that that my cats understand at least a few words. So anyway, that brings us to this this article here. Is it possible? Why can't apes learn to speak like a human? Obviously, there's been a lot of work over the years, interspecies communication with apes, where apes have been taught sign language. They've been taught many different words. They've been able to communicate with their trainers to at least a maybe the level of a 2 or 3 year old child. It's not like they're discussing, you know, the consequences of life and life after death and that sort of thing and anything like that. But, you know, they can talk about how, you know, me want food, that sort of thing. But there is a little bit of communication that these apes have done with humans. But could they speak? It says here, is it possible for apes to speak English like in the new Dawn of the Planet of the Apes movie? In the hit summer blockbuster, the ability to speak is just one of the human-like traits that the mutant primates possess. But in the real world, we have yet to see any non-human species of primate learn how to talk like we do. Given that it is possible to teach a chimpanzee how to communicate using sign language, why is it that apes are unable to form words and sentences? Is it down to a lack of intelligence, or are they just physically incapable? One notable example of primate communication can be found in the case of a 33-year-old bonobo called Kanzi. Through many years of observing and interacting with humans, Kanzi was able to learn how to understand human language sentences and could respond accurately to verbal instructions. His responses, however, were far from human. He could not speak the words himself, even though he did understand some of them. And by the way, I don't know if it'll... actually, let me read this article first. The biggest problem is that the vocal cords in non-human ape species operate differently to our own, rendering the recitation of human vocalizations impossible. On top of this, there is also the fact that non-human primates are unable to fully understand the concept of syntax, meaning that while a chimp learning sign language can communicate certain words and phrases, it has no concept of forming complex sentences. So while apes are undeniably remarkable in their inability to communicate with us, a combination of mental and physical limitations means that the idea of a chimp having a full conversation with you in English is something that must, for now, remain firmly rooted in the realms of science fiction. I read a book about interspecies and ape communication. I'm not sure if it was Kanzi, but there was an ape. I guess it was a chimpanzee, probably. Might have been a bonobo. But regardless, it had been taught to use, I believe, American Sign Language, ASL. And it was able to communicate with its trainers using sign language. And what was the most fascinating thing about it was it had a child. The ape had a child, and it was teaching its child sign language. So the sign language that the monkey had learned from humans, the monkey was then teaching its child the same sign language, which I just thought was absolutely fascinating. This is endlessly fascinating to me, this idea of communication between species. As noted, I can say certain words and my cats can differentiate certain words, so I'm not really that impressed by an ape that can understand many human words. I'm more interested in the back and forth. You know, my cats cannot tell me what they want, with the exception of when they're hungry, they cry. But they can't speak to me. We can't communicate in any way. They just know some words. I'm more interested in an ape that is able to sort of kind of have a conversation back and forth using sign language, where you say to the ape, for example, like, What would you like to eat? And the ape can say, I would like an apple. And then you can provide it with the apple. That's the kind of thing that just, it just fascinates me. And I always am interested in what the limits are and what the limits will be. If you get just the right chimpanzee who is smart enough, I mean, can you teach it enough sign language that it can have abstract conversations with you, not just simple conversations? But I mean, do chimpanzees have any concept of death, for example? I believe they do. You know, they are known to mourn when another ape passes away. But I mean, what do they know? What do they think? Do they have any sort of idea of what happens when all of a sudden this chimp just is dead? Do they understand death in any way? Now, these would be interesting concepts to discuss with a non-human. And I'm not sure if we ever will, but we certainly have done a little bit of communication with them. So that is very interesting. I've not seen the new Planet of the Apes movie, but I do know that it's gotten some rave reviews. So maybe I'll have to go out of my way to see that. It's been a long time since I saw a movie. A long time. So it's got to be a good movie. You know what? I honest to God have not gone to a movie since Roger Ebert passed away. Because Roger Ebert was the guy who I always trusted his movie reviews. Because for the most part, with an exception or two, we usually always agreed. If he thought a movie was terrible, I thought a movie was terrible. If he thought a movie was great, I usually also thought it was great. So we kind of had the same taste in movies. And so I could always, if a movie was coming out, I could always go and see what Roger Ebert thought about it. And if he gave it 4 stars, I'd go see it. And if he gave it 1 star, unless it sounded just like hilariously bad, I wouldn't go see it. And ever since he's passed away, I have not gone to a movie. That is a true story. Not one single movie since he passed away. This person here says, this is Bradley on Twitter. He says, I wish someone would post those moon photos of the equipment so I don't have to listen to the moonshot debunkers. I guess he's saying if anybody can point him to photos taken of the sighting of the site of the moon landing. I'm sure if you Google them, you could probably find some stuff. So maybe go up there. We've just passed, I believe, was it the 45th anniversary of the moon landing? I believe so. 1969. I was minus 6. So I guess that would be 45 years. So the big anniversary there. This story here is just creepy. But there is an answer to the mystery. I will read the mystery first. And think about this, by the way. Imagine that you are a parent and you've got a young daughter, and this story happens to you. This is from unexplained-mysteries.com. Police officers have been called in to investigate after strange dolls started appearing on doorsteps. That's right. Everybody's favorite topic. Haunted dolls. It says here that residents were left baffled and concerned when the porcelain dolls, which started to show up outside homes around this neighborhood in San Clemente, not only were these dolls showing up at people's houses, but the dolls were found to resemble the young girls who happened to live at these addresses. A total of 11 dolls were left. However, there were no notes to explain the purpose behind them. Is it a prank? Is there some specific motivation? Asked Lieutenant Jeff Hallock. Obviously, there is an indication by some of the parents that the dolls resemble their daughters. Anything that has the potential to involve children causes us some concern. That's right. These dolls were showing up on people's doorsteps. 11 dolls showed up on 11 different doorsteps around San Clemente. And when the parents took a look at these dolls, they realized, my God, this doll looks like my daughter. Well, the mystery has been solved. Investigators were eventually able to trace the dolls back to an adult female who lived in the local area, who it was believed had left the dolls as a gesture of goodwill. And what goodwill? What could be more... What could be a better token of goodwill than to leave a creepy doll at someone's doorstep? I'm sure, of course, they didn't think the dolls were creepy. Officers concluded that nothing malicious had been intended, and the families who had received the dolls have now had their minds put at ease. Investigators have concluded that her motivation was out of goodwill and that she intended it as a kind gesture. So there you go. I'm still not sure I would be, I don't know. I'd still be pretty creeped out. Mystery doll shows up at the house, no note. Looks like my daughter. Huh. No good. By the way, if you are new to this program, then you have not listened over the years to our stories of haunted dolls, then a good primer is to go up on the internet and Google Annabelle the Haunted Doll. And that should give you a good freak out right before going to bed. Annabelle the Haunted Doll. This is After Dark Radio, everybody. My name is Brian Alvarez. We're here every Friday night, 11 o'clock p.m. Pacific, 2 a.m. Eastern, actually. 2 o'clock a.m. Eastern. We will be taking phone calls for the duration of the program. Open line phone calls, anything that is on your mind. Do you have a scary story to tell? Do you have any creepy thing that has happened to you? Have you ever had a crazy doll left on your porch? Have you ever experienced a haunted doll? Have you ever had any sort of haunting experience? We are looking to hear from you. The phone number, 855-478-4478. That is 855-478-4478. Perhaps you have seen something strange in the sky. You are welcome to call in as well. Anything that is on your mind, give us a call. Open lines, 855-478-4478. This is an interesting story here. Afterlife. Now, it's a very interesting story that I'm about to read here. However, the problem with this story is that it is a story from the 70s. And anytime you're going back 40 years, well, I don't know. In the 1970s, famed reincarnation researcher Ian Stevenson encountered a woman who could fluently speak a form of Bengali spoken some 150 years earlier. Modern Bengali contains about 20% English loanwords, Bengali professor P. Powell told Stevenson, but this woman had long conversations with Professor Powell without using a single one. On the other hand, she used more Sanskrit words, just as Bengalis did around 1810 to 1830, the hypothesized time period of her past life. She spoke fluently, as though she were raised in Western Bengal, a region she had many memories of, though she had never been there in this life. She was born and raised in Nagpur, India, speaking Marathi, as well as a bit of Hindi and English. When this woman, Uttara Hudar, was 32 years old, a new personality emerged, calling itself Sharada. Hadar had not talked about remembering a past life before this point. She had a double MA degree in English and public administration, and she was a part-time lecturer at Nagpur University until she started sharing her body with what could be called a discarnate woman. Sharada, the new personality, could not speak or understand any of the languages Hadar could. Sharada didn't recognize Hadar's family or friends, and presumably this was her as she was... taken over by this spirit or whatever. And she was baffled by the many instruments invented after the Industrial Revolution. Hadar's family didn't know any Bengali, and they were unfamiliar with the ethnic foods and other things that Sharada desired. Stevenson and fellow researchers spent a couple of weeks investigating her story over the course of a couple of years. They checked up on places she remembered in Bengal, some of them in modern-day Bangladesh. Her descriptions were accurate in terms of distance between places, geographical layout, etc. She gave the full names of her family members, including her father's name, Brajanath Chattopadhyay, when Stevenson found a genealogy of a family living in the region Sharada described as home, he discovered Sharada had correctly named and described her relationship with five of her family members, including her father and grandfather. These family members lived during the 19th century time frame Sharada's accounts seemed to describe. So there are all sorts of different things that she remember. As a child, Hadar had a strong phobia of snakes. Her mother said that while pregnant with Hadar, she had dreamed repeatedly of being bitten by a snake. Sharada recalled that when she was 7 months pregnant and was picking flowers, a snake bit her toe. She said she became unconscious, though she did not explicitly say she remembered dying. At the time, she was 22, and she seemed to have no awareness that any time had elapsed. Sharada would take over Hadar's body for weeks or days at a time, and Hadar's family started to notice that these periods corresponded to certain phases of the moon. So they've got all of these other details here. And the conclusion here is that the fact that the version of Bengali she spoke was also 150 years outdated provided compelling evidence, it was said, along with her intimate knowledge of the food and culture, that perhaps she had been reincarnated. Now, maybe this is all... I mean, clearly the story is accurate, at least the details. But do you believe that she had lived a past life? Perhaps. The one thing I will note is that and I guess this was not the United States of America in the 70s when there was a revolution of a spiritual revolution, so to speak. And there were all sorts of you know, there was talk of past lives and this and that. I mean, I don't know. I just this was a very intelligent woman. Double MA in English and public administration, a part-time lecturer. She's very, very intelligent. And I don't think that you can definitively rule out the possibility that this was all a hoax. Maybe you can, but I don't know. I just, it's very interesting. We need to get somebody on to talk about past lives is really the only way to do this. So... interesting story, but again, based on the time frame, this was 40 years ago. It's not something that can be really investigated today. Based on the fact that the person who's making these claims was a very well-educated, intelligent person, I just can't rule out that maybe there was more to it than necessarily a past life experience. Also this. I like this guy. The man who will stop at nothing to bring free internet to the world. The fight to bring the entire planet online has reached new extremes. On one hand, we have Facebook CEO Mark Zuckerberg, and Internet.org, the nonprofit he founded to bring the developing world online through drone and satellite technology. And on the other hand, we have Google, which is spending millions of dollars to acquire its own drone and satellite operations, while also working to stream internet access from high-altitude balloons. There's nobody in this world that would like 24-hour a day, 365 days a year, anywhere you go, full internet access than me. And so there's this fella here. Costa Grammatis is his name. Though far from the most formidable entrant in this race, this young entrepreneur is no less serious about his mission. He is the founder and CEO of a nonprofit called A Human Right. And since 2009, he's been developing a variety of projects to expand internet access around the world. In 2010, he launched BuyThisSatellite.org, which sought funding to purchase a satellite that could beam internet connections to those without them. 2 years later, MoveThisCable.org successfully lobbied a telecom company to reroute an underwater fiber optic cable so it could bring the remote South Atlantic island of St. Helena online. Anyway, his most ambitious project is Olivus. It is a new kind of telecom that wants to make money by giving away free internet access in the United States and use any profits to support connectivity projects in the developing world. It is a freemium model where you give away basic services and encourage people to pay for additional services, which is a great idea, by the way. I think, since I am basically using a freemium model for our wrestling website, the idea is that this will be successful enough to bootstrap a whole new online universe on the other side of the globe. It says it is a lofty and potentially impossible goal. They are lacking in money, but they are making up for it in good intentions. So this is his idea. BuyThisSatellite.org has cobbled together $67,000, which is a mere sliver of the $1.375 billion that Dish Network paid to acquire TerraStar One. So that's his idea. He wants to bring internet to everybody in the world, no matter where you are, for free. So I guess we shall see. Rick down here in the comment section says the idea of bringing free internet to the Americans cannot work. I will tell you why, he says, because day by day, more and more commercialism is creeping in. Even if my internet bill went away, I would still have to pay for my time to view content. To see much of the internet already requires running commercials first before you get to the content. So I'm paying for content in 15 and 30 second increments, even without a bill. So there you go. I guess what's the proper term? I want internet anywhere. It was rather disconcerting, actually. This is not an internet problem. This is my own fault. But when I went to Calgary, I did not get a outside the U.S. phone package. And so I was without phone, which meant I could not check my Google Maps, which means when I got lost in Kamloops, well, I was lost. I couldn't go on Google Maps to find my way back. And as God is my witness, I got to tell a story here. I got lost, and I was driving clearly the wrong way. I mean, I could just tell by the state of the road that if I would have just kept going on this road, I would not have gotten to Banff. I would have gotten to the North Pole. And so I was forced to turn on my cell phone, which did not have a international roaming package on it. And I had it on for about maybe 5 minutes. I found out where I was at. I found out where I needed to go. I found out the directions. I copied and pasted them, and then I shut off my data again. So as God is my witness, I was maybe using my data for about 5 minutes in Canada without an international roaming package. So we get to the hotel, and the next morning we go across the street to a Tim Hortons. And I get to the Tim Hortons, and they've got free wireless. Thank God for Tim Hortons. And so I'm downloading all my emails, and I have an email from AT&T, which is my cell phone service provider. And AT&T has alerted me that I have spent over $100 on roaming fees. I'm not making this up. I use that phone for 5 minutes to figure out where I was on a tiny Canadian highway outside Kamloops. 5 minutes. And it ran me over $100. I was infuriated. But hey, at the end of the day, it was my own fault. I'll probably call them and see if there's anything I can do to lower the bill. But when I saw that I got hit with a $100 bill for 5 minutes of data in Canada, I learned my lesson. I will never go to Canada again. It was also interesting because we were on our way to Kamloops. And I know that many people listening to this program are big fans of Art Bell, as we all are. And I remember when I was young, you could tune into the AM radio station, and there was Art Bell broadcasting through the night. So I'm on this little, we're driving towards Kamloops, and I've concluded that the entire country of Canada, I believe there's about five big cities, and in between them, there's nothing. There's not even, the biggest town is like, you know, 25 residents. It's just five cities and nothing. Absolutely nothing in between. So I'm driving from Vancouver to Kamloops, or around, you know, we actually went over the Abbotsford, the Sumas border. But I'm driving towards Kamloops, and there's just nothing anywhere. And so I'm searching the AM dial, and I can't find Art Bell. But Coast to Coast AM is on, so I'm listening to some Coast to Coast AM. And at the top of the hour, they cut to the local news. And the local news is talking about how there is a giant fire in Kamloops. And they're talking about there's evacuations. They're talking live to the mayor. He's talking about how terrible this is. People are leaving their homes. The fire is burning on the mountain. It's moving its way up the mountain. You can smell smoke for miles and miles and miles. And I'm like, oh my God, I'm driving to Kamloops. Where am I going here? So I'm driving. It's pitch black in the middle of the night. And I'm expecting to, like, go up and over a hill, and, like, the whole world will be on fire. That's the way they're explaining it on the radio. Like, everything is burning. And I go up over the hill. There's Kamloops. I drove through Kamloops. I got lost in Kamloops. I drove all over, looking all over the place. I did not see one hint of any fire. So I was very disappointed. But the next day, when we got to Banff, it was overcast. And my buddy Lance's wife says, you know that it's not actually overcast? What you're looking at is that's the smoke from the fires in Kamloops. I mean, this was a big-time mother bear of a fire. So anyway, everyone take care of themselves. Take care of yourselves. It's dangerous out there, as my grandmother would say. This guy here from the Telegraph. A waiter awarded a half share of a lottery jackpot after he predicted the win in a dream. Let's think about this here very quickly. A restaurant owner who scooped a million-pound jackpot on the lottery has been forced to share half the cash with one of his staff after a judge ruled that the waiter had dreamt about the win the night before. This guy could not believe his luck when his numbers came up on the Euro Millions draw in January 2012. But his celebrations were cut short when Faith Ozken, who waited tables at the restaurant, demanded half the money, insisting had it not been for him, his boss would never have entered the lottery draw. Mr. Ozken argued that it had been his idea to buy a ticket, having predicted the jackpot win the night before in a dream. So think about this. Imagine that you're at work and a coworker comes up to you and he says, I had a dream last night that you won the lottery. And so you think, well, I'm going to go buy a lottery ticket. And so you go buy a lottery ticket and you pick all the numbers and you win. And you've won all of this money. And after winning the money, your buddy comes back up to you and they said, I'm the one that told you I had that dream. Therefore, you owe me half the money. What would you think about the scenario if this was presented to you? Well, apparently this fella did not agree with his coworker because they went to court. And a judge agreed with the claim and ruled the warring pair had to split the money equally down the middle. The dispute over the win began just hours after the draw was made, with the buddy insisting the jackpot was rightfully his because he had paid for the ticket and had chosen the winning numbers. Actually, this was the winner, not his buddy. So, you, if you are in this person's shoes, you bought the ticket yourself, and you picked the numbers. All your buddy did was tell you that he had a dream you won. And the superstitious buddy, the disgruntled waiter, he contacted the police and lottery organizers. He claimed his boss had... First off, think about this. First, he claimed his boss had stolen the winning ticket from his jacket pocket. So not only... is your buddy insisting that you owe him the money because he told you he had a dream that he won the lottery. Later, he claimed that you stole the ticket from out of his pocket. So, you're arrested for theft, and you're questioned for 9 hours by the police. And then, of course, you go to court and you explain this to the judge, and the judge rules your buddy deserves half. Here's the details of this premonition. He dreamt that he was holding a large bundle of cash, and standing in front of him was his boss. He is a strong believer in the power of dreams, and he interpreted this to mean that he and his boss would win the lottery. This is what he claimed. So the following day, he pestered his boss for 3 hours to buy a lotto ticket, and his boss finally agreed to enter the Euro Millions drawer, which is a lottery. It was the boss who had bought the ticket physically. He physically bought the ticket. But he insisted that the cost and the choice of numbers had been shared. The buddy admitted lying to the police. Think about that. He admitted lying to the police and they still split it right down the middle. So there you go. I'd be upset. Thierry Legault, everybody, our guest tonight. I want you to head up to his website, www.astrophoto.fr. He's got a lot of great stuff up there, a lot of stuff we talked about here tonight, a lot of great photos. You can check out his book, Astrophotography, which is available on Amazon.com, as well as a special here. You can get 40% off the book. That's almost half off if you pre-order it at O'Reilly. Unfortunately, it appears that deal has expired, but you can still go up and check it out at O'Reilly. You can check it out at Amazon.com as well. Check out the book Astrophotography. And a lot of great photographs up there, including shots of the International Space Station traveling in front of the sun. Here's a shot of the space shuttle. That's a great little website, so head up there and check that out. If you missed any of the interview, if you happen to be tuning in late tonight, you can head up to our website, AfterDarkRadioShow.com, and check it out there. It will be airing, available for free download at the website about 20 minutes after the show goes off the air. And of course, on the Dark Matter Radio Network, it will be replaying throughout the day tomorrow. So check out the Dark Matter Radio Network. There's so many great shows up there. I'm actually on the DarkMatterRadio.net website right now. And tons and tons of shows, including some new shows. On Monday, they've added Expanded Perspectives at 11 p.m. Pacific, as well as Exploration, which is airing at 4 o'clock p.m. Pacific. And, of course, we've got the AZ UFO Show, which is 10 p.m. on Wednesdays, also new. 4 o'clock p.m. on Thursdays, and Other News, which is new. Also on Thursday, we've got shows at 10 p.m. and midnight, Night Watch and Spooky South Coast, both new. Big Picture Science, Fridays at 4 o'clock p.m. Behind the Paranormal, new. 10 o'clock p.m. on Fridays, immediately preceding this show. We are live every Friday night on the Dark Matter Radio Network. We'll be back next week with a brand new show as well. You can always check out information on the programs by heading up to AfterDarkRadioShow.com. So make sure you check that out. ArtBell.com is the place to go as well. That is the website run by our illustrious webmaster, Keith Rowland. Always a lot of great shows up there at ArtBell.com. Of course, you can link up to the Dark Matter Radio Network. There's all sorts of news up there. There's an interview, by the way, if you go up there right now, with UFO researcher and author Jacques Vallée, who is one of my absolute favorites. Head up there and check that out. Interview with Jacques Vallée and a lot of other stuff up there as well. So support the Dark Matter Radio Network. Support ArtBell.com. Support the Dark Matter Radio Network, After Dark Radio, and everything like that. So I want to thank everybody for listening here tonight. We'll be back next week with a brand new show. Really appreciate all the support. And until next time, we'll talk to you again after a while.
My shoes shine bright and my hat.